What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
We're going to spend the hour looking at three cities that are dealing with Trump's federal invasion. We're going to start with Chicago with Damon Williams, a movement builder, organizer, performing artist, educator, media creator, and co-director of hashtag Let Us Breathe Collective, an artistic activist organization, Birth of the Ferguson Uprising. Good morning, Damon.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much for being here. Before we get to you, I'm going to roll a tape. A Chicago resident reacting to the ICE raid of an apartment building over the weekend. Let's roll that tape, Kirsten.
They was terrified. The kids was crying. People were screaming. They looked very distraught. I was out there crying when I seen the little girl come around the corner because they was bringing the kids out too. Had them zip tied to each other. That's all I kept asking. Where's the morality? Where's the human? One of them literally laughed. He was standing right here. He said, them kids.
That was a Chicago woman talking to ABC 7 about her perspective on the ICE raid. Damon, I'm going to go ahead and guess that that is from the raid in the apartment building in the Black area, South Shore, that happened over the weekend. I'd like to talk about, and we knew this, right? Because we knew that Chicago, our sister city, Oakland sister city, which is where I'm at, right, has a large Black population. We know that Trump is targeting black-led cities. Chicago is also a city where black-led organizing helps lead the nation. We do a lot of work with folks out there. So we knew what was going to happen, right? I want to talk about what the terrorizing of the black communities in Oakland, in Chicago, has looked like over the last little while.
Well, we saw, as you mentioned, in the middle of the night, a building be raided and elders and children and people while they were sleeping, people while they weren't clothed, being dragged out of their homes, being zip tied, being, you know, disappeared, if we're being honest. Also on the west side of Chicago last week, we saw a young black man in a car chase who was then choked and slammed right over the 290 expressway. And, you know, I think the horror of it is awakening some of us who maybe thought, you know, that this was about somebody else or that citizenship was a protection. And it really, I think, has been an unfortunate and violent dose of political education for folks of, you know, fascism, state violence, bigotry, white supremacy is coming for us all. And there are no carve outs that will protect us.
Right. I mean, it was a conversation I had with our relatives, right, when they first descended on L.A. And some of us were like, that's not our problem. We're going to sit this one out. And my response was, if you don't think they're coming for you next.
Yeah.
Which you have not been paying attention. Right. You haven't paid attention to the last 450 years in this country. Damon, can you talk about what conversations, if any, are happening between black immigrant communities and black communities, black people that were born here? Struggle with the right way to say that, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, and you know, want to be honest and fair of, like, there is tension or familiarity within community that folks experience in different ways, but I really want to emphasize that for the last 10 to 15 years, there has been deep solidarity between the organizing in our community. So black organizers and Latinx organizers, immigrant organizers have been on the front lines with each other. One of the first direct actions I did when the International Association of Chief of Police came here and Barack Obama was their keynote speaker and we shut down their conference in 2015 of the Movement for Black Lives. It was organizers from organized communities against deportation that trained us that, you know, and so from the coalition tables we sit at, from the policy demands that we come together, there's been a long standing solidarity, which is also, you know, coming together now. With that, there's always deeper connection within both communities about how we internalize the messages of white supremacy, of anti-blackness, of xenophobia. And so that education is happening through Know Your Rights work, through Unpacking This Moment. But also there is deep empathy and deep understanding that, like, we are in this together and that black and brown folks' fates have been linked on this continent for centuries.
Before I get back to the doom and gloom, as an organizer, where do you see the opportunity here for organizing in ways that build power to change material conditions?
Yeah, I think it's shifting the political landscape. And for me, one of our biggest barriers has been the passiveness and, the cowardice of centrism. And I think this moment is making clear that like the centrists just like go with the status quo or, don't shake the apple cart approach that many folks, in establishment circles have kind of pushed for is no longer a viable option. Not only do we need to protect and resist what's happening, but in order to make sure that it doesn't continue or expand, we actually need liberatory approaches. We need a radical approach to drastically reshape how governance is working because it is designed actually to collaborate with fascism. This whole history of US imperialism has had fascistic colors and tones and hues. And now that it is being articulated at this height, it's really, I think, expanding what our assignment is. And so when we talk about divesting from militarism, people for years were saying we should actually be defunding ICE. And now that we saw that it's got a blank check, that demand looks a little less naive or a little less pie in the sky once we see the dial go to the other extreme.
And to your point that you made earlier, from my perspective as an organizer, this opportunity blows up the divisive narratives of white supremacy that has kept black and brown communities from fighting together for so many decades. Yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think we are seeing now that the, militarism in all of its forms, whether that's globally, whether that's on the border, whether that's with ICE and DHS or, whatever National Guard bodies that he can bring together, and also the Chicago Police Department and the Oakland Police Department and the LA Police Department function toward or Israel and Palestine, like function towards this same destructive, dehumanizing. And similarly, we see that Black people of color across the planet are not just, getting less resources, but are the explicit targets of murderous violence, of torturous violence, of political violence. And that shared fate requires us to be in a form of solidarity towards liberation.
I had on our friend Iceland Pulley, along with my brother, Chairman Fred, on a couple of weeks ago to talk about Chicago when this all first started to explode. And I had a question for them both on my ASQ because I wonder what it looks like different. My first thought was, regardless of what the mayor says, oh, and his response around ASADA passing. Listen, I almost moved to Chicago, first of all. Second of all, I was just like, okay, well, the mayor can write the mandate that CPD is not allowed to cooperate, but it's the CPD. So I'm wondering what you've seen in terms of collaboration or cooperation between CPD and the feds, if any.
Well, we haven't seen, from my knowledge, like explicit operational cooperation. If you hear anecdotes of cops kind of being on both sides of the middle of being passively like that's not how things are supposed to go, or being passively kind of chuckling or part of the peanut gallery. But we have started to see that ICE tear gas is also affecting CPD offices. But we want to be clear that like we do not expect the Chicago Police Department to save us, and that their job is to police, is crowd control, is ultimately to be on the side of the carceral apparatus, even if their mandate right now is one that's better than what's happening in other cities. And so, yeah, we're starting to see some of that division, some of that divide. Historically, there have been, and similar as we had organizing on military bases, there have been resistant factions within policing, and we have not yet seen that contemporarily in Chicago. So that is an opportunity. But as an abolitionist, I think, it is clear to note that a big part of this attack on Chicago actually started in 2016 because organizers shut down Trump's first campaign rally when he was running for his first term. And the biggest contingency, the biggest support of MAGA, which then was Blue Lives Matter, was the Chicago Police Department. We know that our police union is deeply organized in Proud Boy tendencies and January 6th tendencies. And there's a spectrum, obviously. But with that is not an entity that we have faith in or see as saving us. But we do appreciate the harm reduction of this explicit mandate to not comply.
You reframe my whole question. I was like, CPD is about to collaborate with the feds and mess up black people because that's just how dirty they be. But I appreciate the reframe of organizing terms. Damon, more than 1,000 immigrants have been arrested since the crackdown started last month in Chicago area. Folks, as you mentioned, who also have papers or were born here, American citizens, have also been arrested. Talk about what it's like walking through the streets of Chicago right now. What does it feel like? What does it look like? What's the chill factor?
You know, it's a little surreal because most times in most places, it is like day-to-day life. But you'll see within some of our organizing channels, there's an immediate call to deploy. We're seeing, particularly in like a near suburb, Bridgeport, where ICE detention facility is housed, that folks are being brutalized and attacked in deep ways. We're seeing them really target downtown in a way that is both scary and violent, but also like a little ridiculous. Like they look like losers a lot. And so that, you know, they're taking boats down the Chicago River and pointing assault rifles at architectural tours. So there's this like, yes, surreal nature to it because the day to day is continuing, but that at the same time, we'll see 9 military helicopters flying over, or we'll see a deployment on a specific neighborhood. And so it's not like a standing occupation, which is what makes it scarier. And particularly now that we're seeing many folks in unmarked vehicles and not in uniform. So it's just fair-skinned or white men in mass jumping out and attacking people in a way that is really frightening and really dangerous. But at the same time, life is continuing, you know? And so that's a whole hard balance to kind of reconcile of things are scary, there's things to panic about, but we don't know where it's coming from at all times.
I was thinking about that this morning, actually, you know, and they haven't gotten here yet. I think there's a reason for that we don't have time to get into. But I was thinking about this, I was like, I'm getting up, right? We're just continuing as cogs in the wheel of the system while the system has escalated, right? I'm not going to say started, escalated its attacks on our bodies. And I think about the ways in which that black folks walk around with cognitive dissonance in this country anyway, right? And how this is just exacerbating that, I think, for so many of us, right? The emotional and mental trauma are things that we're going to be, you know, that we should be actively dealing with right now, but we're going to be trying to reconcile for quite some time. Damon, I know I don't have very much longer with you. I mean, I was already covering Chicago in part because I've got loved ones there and also because it's where this fool is right now. But part of the conversation, started this conversation was a text that I got from my sister, Melina Abdullah, in Los Angeles, talking about the media blackout that has happened about the raids that have happened in Chicago, including the shooting of two people. One man, I believe, died. Can you talk about the woman and the man that were shot? And then B, can you talk about the, is there a media blackout? Is local media not telling these stories?
I would say local media is not telling the stories with the appropriate energy and tone. You know, I think particularly the raid on the South Shore building and the young man over the expressway did get attention because now this thin veil of citizenship is starting to fall down as a facade. But no, there's definitely not enough attention of naming it as fascism, of naming it as a military occupation. They're still using vocabulary and language of crackdown on illegal immigration, which is, you know, I think affirming the framework that is allowing this attack in the first place. And yes, we are grieving the fatality, and we are responding to the shooting that happened, and understanding that for many folks who have maybe been movement facing, have seen, you know, what it feels like to be on the front line, have seen the batons, have seen the shields, and it is clear that this is an escalation. That, you know, the difference from rubber bullets versus fatal attack, the difference between being able to have, you know, the National Lawyers Guild go to the assigned police precinct and then petition to get someone out versus folks being disappeared and not knowing where they are. There is an intensity, a horror, an intentional terror or terrorism to these tactics that are disorienting. But at the same time, I really want to affirm and celebrate that from the immediate moment of this announcement and kind of in a nonstop fashion, organizers and just regular people who are provoked by this moment are showing up and saying, we're not going to stand for this. And so there has been a real energy of noncompliance. We see, even if it may be symbolic, like business owners not allowing ICE agents or DHS officials to, you know, come and have a lunch break or to come use the bathroom. And so there is an escalating of consciousness that is valuable and that we want to celebrate, but don't want to diminish just how frightening and how disorienting this time is for our city and for our people.
Like I told another national organizer, longtime vet in this work, that texted me a couple months ago as all this was coming on. She said, sis, is it going to be bad? I wrote her back. I said, yeah, it's going to be real bad. Howsomever, this is what we trained for. We're going to be all right. Damon Williams, thank you so much for joining me this morning. We will talk again.
I appreciate you. Hope to talk soon.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.